Hello. Welcome to the Bore You to Sleep podcast. The podcast that will hopefully help you get to sleep. I am going to read an open source book, one that is not particularly interesting, but one that is hopefully boring enough to get you to sleep. Hello. Before we begin, a quick note. The Bore You to Sleep podcast relies on you and sponsors, which means you will hear a quick advertisement before the beginning of tonight's episode. While the podcast is free, you are welcome to subscribe for just $2.99 per month, which supports the creation of this podcast and gives you an ad-free listening experience. Simply click the link in the show notes from your podcast app. Rest easy. Tonight's reading comes from Harry Muir, A Story of Scottish Life. Written by Mrs. Oliphant and published in 1853, this story explores everyday interactions in a way that still feels relevant today. My name is Teddy, and I aim to help people everywhere get a good night's rest. Sleep is so important, and my mission is to help you get the rest that you need. The podcast is designed to play in the background while you slowly fall asleep. Thank you to everyone who shared their words of gratitude with me during the week, whether it be through the website or your podcast app. One of the most rewarding aspects of the podcast is hearing from all of the listeners who found the podcast beneficial. A huge thank you and welcome to all new subscribers of the podcast. It's your support that allows me to keep bringing out episodes for those who need them. Thank you to all Spotify listeners who took the time to leave a response in the episode Q&A. My goal truly is to keep the podcast free in order to allow people who need a good night's rest to get that rest. If you find the podcast beneficial, there are a few ways you can support the creation of this podcast. For $2.99 per month, you can become a subscriber and also ensure that you remove any Spotify ads at the beginning of each episode. It's very easy to do. You just click in the show notes and follow the link. If becoming a paid subscriber is not possible, an easy way to support the podcast is to simply leave a review and rating in your podcast app. It's always so great to hear from listeners, and if you would like to say hello to me, you can say hello at boreyoutosleep.com. In the meantime, lie back, relax, and enjoy the readings. Harry Muir, A Story of Scottish Life, by the author of Passages in the Life of Mrs. Margaret Maitland, Adam Graham, and Merkland. Chapter 1. The Count is neither sad nor sick, nor merry nor well, but civil, Count, civil as an orange, and something of that jealous complexion, much ado about nothing. On the eve of the important party, Cuthbert Charteris arrived at Allender's, half frozen with his journey, and shaken from his coat large flakes of the snow, which trembled in the air. They took him into the dining room, where a blazing fire, a late dinner, and the warm and smiling welcome of Agnes greatly solaced the wayfarer. Harry had met him in Stirling and driven him out, but Harry's carriage, though it could be closed, was not so comfortable on a December night as in the bright sunshine of a July day. Cuthbert made hurried inquiries after Martha and Rose, in answer to which Agnes began a most animated account of an unexpected call from young Mr. Dunlop, to say that his sister would be very happy to come with him to Agnes's party. Little Mrs. Muir Allenders had only ventured at the last moment to invite the baronet's daughter, and then with but the faintest expectation that Miss Dunlop would come. Agnes was greatly elated, and Rose and Martha were with Mr. Dunlop in the drawing room. But on the peaceful countenance of Cuthbert Charteris, there passed a momentary savageness. At this moment, it seemed to him, in unconscious self-estimation, that he, as the newly arrived guest and tried friend, should be the principal person at Allender's, whereas this young Mr. Dunlop, most probably a nobody, as Cuthbert concluded with amiable liberality, defrauded him of his welcome from the sisters, and drew away Harry from his side. It was true that Harry returned in 10 minutes, and that Martha and Agnes changed places, but still, Cuthbert involuntarily frowned. Might not Rose, in common courtesy, have come to greet him? Alas, poor Rose, for Cuthbert could not tell how she trembled at the bright fireside of the drawing room, nor how the astonished Agnes threw shawls round her shoulders and wondered what could make her so cold. Mr. Charteris lingered long over his dinner. Cuthbert, to tell the truth, was rather sullen, and made by no means a brilliant appearance to Martha and Harry, who sat with him while he refreshed himself. He had a great inclination, indeed, to wrap himself up again in his travelling dress, say a surly goodbye at the drawing-room door, and betake himself home without delay. But Cuthbert disconsolately comforted himself that it was only for one day, and sat with all his attention concentrated on the sounds from the staircase, doggedly assuring himself that no one would come, and no one did come, and Cuthbert was enraged at the fulfillment of his own prophecy. By and by, he went upstairs attended by Harry, who did not quite comprehend this singular mood, to his own room, and Rose heard his voice on the stair, and trembled still more and more, though young Mr. Dunlop sat by, and did all that in him lay to engage her attention. But poor Rose felt a great inclination to steal away to her own room and cry, and for she in her turn thought it strange, very strange, that Cuthbert should linger so long and show so little wish to see her. And when Cuthbert, his face still tingling from the cold blast without, entered the warm and cheerful drawing-room and saw young Mr. Dunlop sitting beside the silent Rose, describing to her with animation some storied continental towns from which he had lately returned, the grave advocate felt himself yield to boyish pique and jealous resentment. Civil as an orange, and something of that jealous complexion, the tone of his constrained greeting dismayed Rose, and when he had taken her hand in his own somewhat chill one, and let it fall again with scarcely a pressure, he withdrew to the other side of the room, and began to talk to Martha. Rose, who had not been a very good listener before, became worse than ever now, but Mr. Charteris, trying to look very indifferent, occupied himself almost ostentatiously with Martha, and laughed at his own jokes and became quite exuberant and demonstrative, though he never spoke to Rose. But Rose would not tell her sister when she unexpectedly brought a light to their dark room that night. Why she was crying? It was for nothing at all, Rose protested. Indeed, nothing at all. But faster and faster the tears ran down her cheek, and she had much to do to keep back a rising sob. Martha put her hand over the wet eyes tenderly and did not ask again, for she could guess without explanation the cause of Rose's tears. Next day, Mr. Charteris rode out with Harry to see the improvements. He was much interested in them, he said, and so he was, far more interested than he felt yesterday when he came. Cuthbert had been having a consultation with himself, a consultation in which he looked at various circumstances from a point of view exactly opposite to that of Rose. He saw young Mr. Dunlop, son of the rich Sir John, a wealthier man than he could ever be, devoting himself to her unequivocally, as Cuthbert thought, and Cuthbert in his heart devoutly believed, that Rose's gentle excellence needed only to be seen to win all love and honour. So he gravely asked himself whether it would be right for him, even if it were in his power, to stand in the way, and endeavour to secure for himself, who must struggle for years in the uphill road to success, one who would do honour to this higher rank, which seemed about to be laid at her feet. And Cuthbert, with the self-denial of a man who magnanimously gives up what he sees no hope of ever attaining, said to himself, "No, no." His affection, strong and powerful as it was, should never stand in Rose's way. And this was no small trial to Cuthbert. He had come here prepared to say certain things, which would have made one heart in Allender's leap. He had even gone so far as to confide his intention to his mother, and it was somehow hard now to give it up and go steadily back to his books and his struggles, relinquishing forever the fairy solace of these disappointed hopes. It was hard. Was it right? Cuthbert persuaded himself so, as he rode silently along those wintry lanes, where the snow lay thick under the hedges, and whitened every spray. But Cuthbert did not know how great a share in it belonged to the pride which lay at the bottom of his heart. When he returned to Allender's, Rose was busy with Agnes in preparation for the party. He did not see her, and this brought confirmation to his previous thoughts. Then came the party itself. An ordinary collection of well-looking, well-dressed people, among whom Cuthbert, with his preoccupied thoughts, found very little to interest him. Miss Dunlop, it is true, a well-bred, trained, mature young lady, acquainted with the world, made herself very polite and agreeable, and evidently regarded Cuthbert as one of the most tolerable persons present. But then Mr. Dunlop was at Rose's side again, and Rose looked shy and pale, and embarrassed, shrinking from the glance and touch of her new attendant as an indifferent person could never do. Cuthbert turned away with a great sigh when he perceived her face flush and grow pale. Her hand trembled, her eyes cast down. He thought it was the stranger beside her whose presence called forth these unwilling evidences of maidenly tremor and confusion, and he turned away, feeling as if some burning hand had clutched at his heart. But Cuthbert could not see the wistful glances which, when he painfully averted his eyes, dwelt upon him with inquiring sadness. And when he looked again, Rose was sitting, silent as before, with sudden flushes on her face, and sudden tremors in her frame, answering, it is true, with few words and a little melancholy smile, when anyone addressed her, but entirely failing to make the impression which Harry had predicted for her pink silk gown. And there was Mr. Dunlop, paying his devoirs gallantly, those easy as a duties of word and manner. Cuthbert felt the strong love sicken his own heart, as he said to himself that these charmed the trustful spirit of his Lady Rose. And Mr. Dunlop, observing the changes of her face, at first with a little amusement, very soon came to the same conclusion too, and was embarrassed and annoyed, gratified and proud, for nothing was further from the thoughts of the baronet's son, for whom the magnanimous Cuthbert was willing to sacrifice himself, than any particular admiration of Rose, or the faintest intention of offering himself to the sister of Harry Muir. But the young man was human, and not insensible to ladies' love. He thought, like Cuthbert, that his attractions had overpowered Rose, and his tone insensibly grew tender, and his attentions marked till Rose, able to bear it no longer, stole away. "Poor Rose Allenders," said Miss Dunlop to Cuthbert as Rose left the room. "She seems to think John is in love with her. She is a very nice little girl, I think, but some young ladies are so ridiculous, taking every little attention so seriously. And I really must speak to John." But Cuthbert, if she knew it, could have thrown John out of the window with far greater pleasure than he had handed John's sister to the new piano. And immediately after he sat down for a full hour to watch the door, with so much tenderness and solicitude in his face, that Rose, when she stole in again, brightened as with a sudden sunshine, and Cuthbert's heart lightened a little too. But still it was full of distrust and doubt, and he never drew near her to speak the words, or hear the response, which might have set this doubt at rest. The night was over, and nothing but the most ordinary civilities had passed between them. Next morning he was to go away. He stood on the threshold in his rough travelling coat and plaid, saying goodbye, with a voice which slightly faltered. He had shaken hands with Rose in the dining room, where they breakfasted, and now he thought he was taking farewell of Allenders. But as he looked back between Martha and Agnes, who had come with him to the door, Cuthbert saw a shy lingering figure in the doorway of the room he had left. His heart warmed. He stepped back to take Rose's hand again, and press it kindly in another farewell. They said nothing except goodbye, but Cuthbert caught one timid upward glance, and Rose saw the full steady look which conveyed to her so much of what the heart meant to say. The cloud rose from her and floated away. In another moment Cuthbert was gone, and she sat down to her work in intense silence, eager to resume her dreams, but Cuthbert rolled away on the frosty road, and looked back on Allender's with a sadness in his heart. He had hitherto unconsciously assumed to himself the right of assistance, and succour in any emergency should come. Now he felt this gliding away from him. Now he could no longer dream of carrying this rose in his arms to the safe place, where rains of adversity might beat upon its gentle heart no more. The future of which he had speculated so much grew misty and uncertain to Cuthbert. The little cloud of breath before him, hovering in the frosty air, rose up like a white mist upon distant Benledi, and obscured him though he looked out from among the clouds, and so over many a great event and many a weighty hour, this little present mist rose dim and disheartening, and Cuthbert could not look beyond it, could not in his blended pride and eagerness and anxiety distinguish the simple truth under this momentary veil. But Harry, by his side, spoke of his projects, and Cuthbert seemed to listen, and gave answers not so far astray, though Cuthbert's thoughts were little employed about Harry's improvements, and it cost him an effort to keep up his attention. They parted very cordially, however, and Harry urged upon his friend repeated invitations to return, which Cuthbert was fain to evade. He remembered Rose's parting glance and could not prevail upon himself to resign the chance of going back. But again he thought of the previous day, the previous night, and sighed to himself heavily as he turned his face towards home. He thought he had looked his last upon Rose. When Harry left Cuthbert, he went to his bankers and drew a very considerable sum from his capital. But Harry felt he had been very economical lately, and could afford a little indulgence now. So he ordered some pretty bits of jewellery which he had fancied Agnes wanted last night, and called on Gilbert Allender's and some other choice spirits, and dined with them at the principal inn, and spent the evening merrily. Nor was it until John had made repeated representations of the darkness of the night, and the necessity for getting home, that Harry suffered himself to be persuaded, and bade a reluctant good night to his friends. Charteris was bending over a mass of papers, schooling the heart which still throbbed so loudly, and wearying himself out with indifferent business, that his disappointment might not sit too near the source of his strength. When Harry, wearied by quite a different process, drove past the dark and silent houses at Maitland Cross, the labourers there were lying down to the untroubled slumber purchased by a toilsome day, and the children were asleep in Allender's, and Martha was standing by the window of her own room, looking out into a darkness so profound that it made her blind, and feeling a darkness profounder still within the heart, which she coerced into absolute silence, when drowsy and wearied out, dazzled with the lights and annoyed by the quietness, Harry came home. "I have a great mind to practice out here, Harry," said Gilbert Allenders. "Lots of scarlet fever and measles and whooping cough to start a man. And I want to be decent and respectable and get out of temptation. If you were in an interesting position like me, I'd get you a couple of rooms at Allender Mains and invite you to dinner every day till you were set up. Interesting children of Maidland, you don't know how much you want a doctor." "And would you actually come out here in winter, Gilbert?" said Harry. "You don't know how dull it is sometimes." Harry drew his hat over his eyes and returned very gruffly the passing salutation of Gordy Paxton. It was now a week since he had visited his fields, and that was more than time to make Harry sick, as he said, of the whole concern. "The duties of my profession, sir," said Gilbert solemnly. "A medical man is always a martyr to the public and his duty. Always. By the way, Harry, what would you say to take a run up to town for a week or two, just before settling down? I think it would do me good." And Mr. Gilbert laid his hand on his heart and sighed. "To town? Do you mean to Stirling? I am there often enough already," said Harry. "Stirling," Mr. Gilbert put up his hand to arrange the great woolen cravat he wore and laughed hoarsely. "You don't fancy I call that little hole of a place town. How innocent you are after all." "Am I?" Harry felt himself grow very angry and kicking away a stone which happened to lie beside his foot. Sent it spinning through a group of Maidland boys, dispersing themselves and their balls in all directions. If it had only broken Gilbert Allender's shins instead, it would have pleased Harry better, but even this was a satisfaction. "Very well aimed," said Gilbert approvingly. "What I mean is London town. There is but one town in the world. Come up with me, Harry, and I'll help you to enjoy yourself. Come." "Help me to enjoy myself, will you?" said Harry scornfully. Harry was more impatient of his companion today than he had been for a long time. "Come, come now. We're old companions now," said Gilbert. "And I know you wouldn't dislike going to London. A man of your years and station, who has never been in London, is something quite unparalleled. The country should subscribe for a glass case and show you in it as a real old country gentleman, who has never been in town all his life, and never means to go." "There is such a thing as going too far," said Harry haughtily. "Who was it said that the first night I saw you?" said the malicious Gilbert. "Don't you remember? But I won't aggravate you, Harry, and you needn't look as if you could eat me. Come, will you go?" "I don't care for seeing London. What is it to me?" said Harry with dignity. "Just half a dozen big towns compounded into one. What should send everybody to London? At the same time, perhaps I may go. It's just as well there as staying at home here, doing nothing, and there is really nothing to be done on the land just now in such a frost." "You have been quite a hero, Harry," said Gilbert. "Few men, I can tell you, could have done what you have done. You ought to give yourself a little rest." "Such a thing as this now," said Gilbert, pointing to a line of carts slowly proceeding with much ringing of horses' hoofs and carters' clogs along the frosty, widened road. Just to let stand those odorous carts pass by might upset a man of your organization. Yet you've been among them constantly for some 2 months now. I envy you your force of resolution, Harry. Poor Harry. This piece of flattery mollified his irritated temper more easily than anything else could have done. Half conscious that he had already abandoned this last night, most costly toy of his, it salved his conscience to have his perseverance wondered at. He put his arm in Gilbert's with sudden friendliness. "I think I shall go after all," he said. "Armstrong can manage everything well enough. He has been accustomed to this sort of thing all his life, and to tell the truth, it requires that, I am afraid, to make a farmer, that is to say, your thorough, enthusiastic farmer. But now that January is over, I think a few weeks' change would quite set me up again. Besides, spring always reconciles one to the country. So I fancy we may settle upon going, Gilbert. When shall you be ready?" "In a day, any time," said Mr. Gilbert, shaking the thin powdery snow from the hedge by a blow of his cane. "I haven't three ladies to look after me, as you have. The girls have their own affairs to mind, and so has the mama. I get my wardrobe to superintend myself, different from you, Harry. And not quite sure whether to be pleased and accept this as a token of his superior importance, or to resent it as a check upon his manliness and independence." Harry began immediately to discuss the projected journey, how they should go and when, and it was soon decided, very much more to Gilbert's satisfaction than to the good pleasure of Agnes and Martha at home. For Agnes found out many little objections and urged them with some pique and displeasure. Agnes thought she herself, his wife, would have been a much more suitable companion for Harry than Gilbert Allender's, and she should have greatly liked to go to London, even at risk of leaving the baby. Martha said nothing. Her hope was gliding out of her hands again, defying all her eager attempts to hold it, and steady darkness, darkness as of the Egyptian night, tangible and positive, was settling down upon Martha's heart. "So you have had our Edinburgh friend here again, Miss Rose," said Mr. Gilbert. "I suppose he will condescend to be civil with you. What is the man, Harry? Nothing but a Scotch W.S., I suppose." "He is an advocate and a gentleman," said Rose under her breath. And when she had said this, she turned to the window, fearful of disclosing the vivid blush which covered her whole face. "When I called upon him with Harry in July, I would not say in presence of ladies what my impulse was," said Gilbert, lifting his large bony hand and displaying his ringed finger in relief against the back brushwood about his chin. "He looked at me with a malice which disgusted me. I suppose he thought I was in his way," added Mr. Gilbert, complacently bestowing upon Rose, who had just turned her head, roused and defiant, a most emphatic look of admiration. And Harry laughed. Rose turned her eyes to him slowly, and felt her heart burn. That Harry should think so meanly of her as to fancy Gilbert Allender's could stand in Cuthbert's way. But when Mr. Charteris looks at you, Rosie, whispered Violet, his lips a moves and the lid comes over his eye. Last time he looked as if he could greet. What was that for, Rose? But Rose made no reply. There were, as Gilbert prophesied, great preparations in Allender's for Harry's departure, and various purchases made that Harry's appearance away from home might be worthy the station which his little wife thought so exalted. None of them were quite prepared for the total insignificance which always falls upon a solitary visitor to London. And when Gilbert, putting up his own little carpet bag, took occasion to remark, sneeringly, upon the great new shining promontory, which Harry carried neither himself nor Agnes, who had come to Stirling to see him away, were angry. They said poor Gilbert, in a sympathetic look, and compassionated him, who had neither rank to maintain nor a little wife to help him to maintain it. And when Agnes, as she went away, casting wistful looks behind her at Harry, caught a glimpse of Gilbert's great, sallow, unwholesome face, surmounted by its little travelling cap, and encircled by its coarse, wiry hair, she could almost have been bold enough to turn back and follow Harry. And that concludes tonight's reading. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this story, and I also hope that you're feeling a little drowsy. If you're not quite tired yet, please feel free to listen to another episode of the Boy to Sleep podcast. Until next time, good night.